made to stick, that for a message to stick, it must be simple, unexpected, concrete, credible, emotional, filled with stories. As coaches, we must teach our important points with the preceding criteria. Like a great trader who can point out the most important technical levels, a great teacher communicates each important teaching lesson with these principles. Does a great trader have the discipline and knowledge to do so? Builds on a firm foundation. An outstanding trader may have developed a trading system above your skill level. His system may just be too complicated or difficult for you to execute at this stage of your trading career. You may not be able to recognize when exactly to short 70,000 SKF when he can. You may not have the skills to manage that position if it initially trades against you. When you begin, 300 SKF may be all that you can handle. Consistently profitable traders constantly evaluate their trading system. They make adjustments every month, every day, and even intraday. I have substantially changed my trading system 6 times since I began. I have traded through the Asian financial crisis, tech boom, internet boom, bursting of the internet bubble, 9/11, a range-bound market, and now the near collapse of the banking system. Every day is new. There is no system to learn. It is about developing trading skills and then making adjustments continually. A new trader must start by learning the basics. Architecture students do not start by designing skyscrapers. New traders must focus on developing trading skills, discipline, and controlling their emotions. They must develop a foundation from which they can build. They should start with straightforward trading setups. Simply, they should first learn how to trade. RIM. Learn how to trade. One of the most helpful and funniest traders on our desk one day complained about getting stopped out in a RIM trade. During our morning meeting, we identified 82 as a level. Steve shared that he would look to short near this level. We even tweeted RIM as our best morning idea. Before each open, SMB tweets its best morning idea for the Twitter and StockTwits communities. This trader showed me his executions and explained how he shorted at 82 and got stopped out above 82.32. RIM immediately traded down to 79 afterward. Some stop-hunting market maker cleared this trader off his book at an intraday high. And then he went back to doing what he was doing to help the firm, without more comment. He seemed content with thinking that he got screwed. My response? You're not kidding, are you? Did I really teach this guy? I think maybe he may have missed a few lectures. There is nothing in our training that suggests that trading is as easy as getting short in front of resistance and watching a stock melt. Sometimes this happens, and these are great trades. But you must also know how to trade. And what I mean by that is that you must also be able to trade this very simple fake breakout that RIM offered. Bear with me on this one. The following rundown of this failed RIM trade and how to improve it gets very technical in a hurry, so brush up on your terminology. 82 is a level. There are trades where this level will hold and the stock will melt. On the open, when the volatility is the highest, makes it less likely that the stock will just hold this resistance level. It is very possible that RIM will quickly trade above 82, shaking out weekend shorts. Of course, you short RIM near 82. You short some near 82 and wait to see if the 82 level holds. If it quickly trades above 82, then you short some more above, perhaps 82.17, since 82.25 is a level. When RIM trades above 82.25, you watch to see if it holds above this level or just immediately cover. If you cover and the stock does not hold a bid above 82.25, then you whack the bids again. Now you actually have a better short than you originally had, since there are more short-term players long above 82 that now have to hit the bids caught short. But you must be able to trade this level with more than one simple result, a held offer at 82. And there are going to be more subsets of this resistance level trade on the open. and you must learn how to trade each of these subsets. The big picture is still the same. You have points of downside and minimal risk that RIM will trade higher as of yet. Crush this trading opportunity. With a trading foundation, you can trade all the different ways RIM may trade around or a little above 82 on the open and crush this trade. With the mindset that all you must do is follow prescribed levels, then you are going to get stopped out, complain, and lose money. The market demands more. The market does not reward the trader seeking lazy trades. Buy here and sell here. When I attended the 2009 Trader Expo, where I also gave a speech to the trading masses, there was some absurd trading system being sold that tells people where to buy when their screen becomes green and sell when their screen turns red. They had about 1,000 more visitors than we did over the course of a weekend. Anyone who thinks that trading is that simple deserves the consequences that are about to follow. Trading losses, and lots of them. The market is always changing. Setups that worked yesterday may not work tomorrow. It is paramount to develop trading skills so traders can adjust to market changes. You say tomato, I say tomato. One of our better traders once shared with me his frustration that he could not trade like Steve, who can watch 8 open positions simultaneously, like some kind of supercomputer. Moreover, I know of numerous examples at multiple prop firms where the positions of superstar traders initially visible by firm members were taken down. These firms were suffering losses as weaker traders tried to copy the superstar. Without fully developed trading skills, novice traders were unable to execute these advanced setups. A superstar teacher, however, will teach you comprehensive trading skills so that you gravitate toward a style that is best for you. The importance of the principle was highlighted by Los Angeles Lakers guard Derek Fisher commenting on his coach, the aforementioned Phil Jackson. He doesn't try to control you. He empowers you to be who you are. In an anecdote I found while doing research for this book, Boris Stein of Stein Management, LLC, a program trader, shared his lowest moment as a trader occurred after trying to trade the mechanical systems of several famous traders and losing much money. In an interview with Traders World magazine, Mr. Stein replayed a painful learning experience. One of my first trades was in 1996, and I wanted to apply some lessons from a book about placing stop orders. I placed a stop order to buy the S&P above the current price, and after getting filled, I placed a protective stop-loss order below the current price. Both stop orders were placed at the levels recommended in the book, and I was not going to move my stops no matter what, because it was described as the biggest trader's sin. Right after my buy order was filled, the S&P went straight down, and my stop-loss was hit. After stopping me out, the price went straight up. I lost $5,000 in 25 minutes. My buy price was the exact high of the day, and my sell price was the exact low of the day. To this day, I still cannot believe it. Now, it's quite possible some savvy shark market maker saw this newbie chump's orders and separated him from his $5,000 with relative ease. But Stein quickly recognized that he couldn't trade out of a book like these stars without first learning the basics. He needed to develop his own system. We trade an active short-term style at SMB. There have been traders on our desk whom I have recommended trade elsewhere because our style is not best for them. Ed Sakota, of Market Wizards fame, offered on this topic, "There is no best system, any more than there is a best car. There might, however, be a best car for you." These traders were better suited for a slower, longer-term trading style, perhaps accompanied by some analysis that an investment banker would use on a balance sheet. They could not process all the indicators that we watch and make millisecond decisions, or this was just not their trading niche. Chart climber. One of these traders was one of my favorite people we have trained. Chart climber, named for his affection for all things charts, was intellectually curious. He would email me articles from The New Yorker or The Onion that I had missed. During the 2008 election, he was one whose thoughts I most enjoyed concerning Pakistan, the bailout, and tax increases. This former prop trader was linked to numerous chat rooms and other traders via IM. He had worked for too many years in one of those jobs that no one could possibly enjoy after a few years, and loved trading with us. At the first firm in which SMB was housed, where space allocated to SMB was limited, we were asked to cut this trader from our desk. I refused. In fact, this was partially the reason why we ended up finding a new home. Traders make a firm, not some non-trader in a back office keeping the books. Steve and I, traders, knew best who should stay and who should be cut. During a group meeting explaining our move, I spoke from my heart. Traders are the most important part of any firm. Traders decide the future of a firm. This firm will always be run by traders for traders, and we will not be forced to cut any of our hard-working traders, even if they are our weakest, if they are working hard, adding value, and making progress. Chart Climber was the most optimistic trader we had ever trained. He would make a chop into the close, and this was the only trade he remembered for the month. He was like a hacker golfer who made an 80-foot par on the 18th hole, and all he could remember during drinks in the clubhouse was that miracle bomb he drained. But after a substantial time, he just wasn't making money with us. The landlord who wanted us to cut Chart Climber was correct in the end, but at the wrong time and, most important, for the wrong reasons. It was not fair for us to let him believe we were the best firm for him going forward. We were not losing much money on him, but he wasn't in the right place for himself. And we let him go. For those interested, he does still send me interesting articles, which I always appreciate. He still drops by the office to say hi. And this trader has found a home as a futures trader. Looks inward. Developing traders who wish to make more ought to look inward. Most new traders need to become better at the setups that are working for them, make more of them, and learn to add size in these trades incrementally. They also need to eliminate their mental weaknesses. Contemporaneously, but slowly, they should add new setups to their quiver. This is the path to improving profits. As traders, we can learn from Abraham Lincoln again, who said we must be disciplined by the better angels of our nature. Poor traders blame their trading platform. They blame those who sit next to them. They complain about the AC. They harp on things out of their control, such as SEC taxes, ECN charges, and data fees. There is always something or someone to blame. Yet often, these are the same traders who miss easy setups, never conquer their psychological demons, and wouldn't think of keeping a detailed trading journal. And their mind wanders. If only I were taught by the best trader on the street, then I would be doing better. I don't think so. For example, one trader I know who needs to improve holds his trades for too short a time. For him, there are not enough trades to hold in his quiver. Almost every trade is just a move-to-move trade. This trader was recently moved to sit near some guys who understand the big picture better. This developing trader needs to identify the trades that are best for him to hold. Then this youngster needs to work on actually holding these trades and not exiting so quickly as he almost always does. We could sit this young trader next to Steve Cohen, and this would still be his issue for him to improve. Of course, Mr. Cohen might just tell him to hold or be fired. Practices patience. A great trader may not be patient enough to work with a new trader. Perhaps it is a lack of desire to be a mentor, or frustrated when the protege doesn't get it as easily as the master. At times, I have these thoughts. For example, one of our talented young traders was not a fan of our loss limit rules. But when he started, he just could not keep his profits from the open. As we discussed, we have a rule on our desk that you cannot give back more than 30% of your profits from the open during the midday. And if you violate this rule, then we reduce your tier size the next day. At one point early on, the young trader ripped it up during the midday, when all our stats show traders do the worst. In fact, this loss limit rule was put in place because of traders like him. Steve sent him an email informing him that he would be enforcing the rules, much to the chagrin of this newbie. This likable young trader responded angrily via email that this is not fair, kind of like a fifth grader. Now, this is not the first time this has happened, and the rule was implemented for his benefit. A great trader may not have the patience to respond to this trader. A great trader may just tell this newbie, "Shut the expletive deleted up already and stop losing money midday." I cringe relaying this particular anecdote. While trading on a prop desk in the middle of my career, I watched a promising young trader get bounced by an excellent trader with only, "You are through. Get the hell off of our desk. Go lose money for someone else." Back when I started with Steve, our mentors thought cutting-edge instruction was 100 push-ups for every mistake we made trading. Speaking of acting like a fifth grader. But research shows that only about 20% of children and adults are able to handle put-downs without emotional pain or psychological damage. Bobby Knight might take exception to this data. It takes 4 positive comments to make the impact of 1 negative comment to most. Mark Twain said, "I can live for 2 months on a good compliment." I have found that every trader is different. Some, if you raise your voice, become very uncomfortable, almost causing a traumatic experience for them. Others, if you are not screaming at the top of your lungs, do not pay attention. Coaches need to think carefully before they speak, so they are providing targeted, individual messages and feedback to their students, which is best for their development. I was on a long overdue summer vacation to the pristine Outer Banks. A call with one of our remote traders who had been struggling had been set up for me. This trader had taken a special master's program in Switzerland to learn more about the markets. He was previously a professional pop musician. This trader, let's call him Pop Trader, wanted to talk. He had been trading so poorly that Steve cut off his buying power. Now, as much as this trader was technically fired, there was still the possibility for us to continue our relationship. On Sundays, he sent me detailed analysis of his trading progress. He was also just about the nicest person you could ever meet. Pop Trader calmly and respectfully relayed that, in his opinion, he had been cut off too quickly. He mentioned that we teach improving every day, and this was his focus, and now it was unfair that he was just dismissed. This set me off. "Offer whatever critique you want about the firm that I've built, but do not label anything we do as unfair." Our desk had outperformed the street in August 2009, and he lost money. Our traders were in the stocks in play, and he was in mostly non-moving garbage stocks day after day. Our desk had mastered momentum trading, and he was fearful to jump into them. Popstar continually failed to hit stocks that traded against him. I felt Popstar was using our mantra, "improve every day," as an excuse. He clearly was not doing everything possible to improve every day. He was in the wrong stocks, unable to conquer a common psychological hurdle, and resisted trading the stocks in play. I pointed out his underperformance and lack of improvement heatedly. Popstar listened. Eventually, after exhausting any frustration one could muster while looking directly out at the ocean, I asked him to write me an email about some issues he needed to improve. He agreed, and I hung up the phone. Talk about being a horrible teacher. What a mistake by me. I did not listen. Popstar was not one to respond to loud confrontation. I put my desire to go back to whatever I was doing on vacation before his progress. I was disrespectful. I did not teach him as much as I could during our conversation. I hung up the phone, singed with embarrassment. In fairness to myself, I was not mentally prepared to field this call since I was on a much-needed vacation. I never got the email I wanted from Popstar. John Wooden wrote in Wooden on Leadership, "Many leaders don't fully appreciate the fact that by telling someone what to do, you must teach him how to do it, and this process requires patience. As a trading teacher, you must explain why a rule is in a trader's best interest. You ought to get the new trader to buy into the importance of this rule, or any rule. The great speechwriter and Wall Street Journal contributor Peggy Noonan in On Speaking Well counseled that the most moving part of a speech is always the logic. Great teachers use solid reasoning to make their teaching points. Being the boss is not a good enough reason to enforce a rule. Well, it may be, but it is not good teaching. Gets tough. It is also the job of a mentor to challenge their students. I empathize with the new trader. Trading is difficult. If a trader is working hard but not yet getting it, then they deserve patience. But standards must be set. And when traders are violating core market principles, their feelings should not be spared. Sometimes you must get a trader's attention by raising your voice. Sometimes the desk struggles or a trader is underperforming. Coach K said on Charlie Rose after his gold medal coaching performance that you have to talk strong in weaker times. And we spend thousands of hours with our traders. Every so often you must communicate in a louder, more passionate voice so they understand the importance of a particular point. In February 2009, I was disappointed with a few traders on our desk, and I called a meeting. I growled, "Your mental preparation is unacceptable. This is your opportunity to do something great. You will not realize your potential until you improve your preparation." This was all premeditated, and like a great actor, I seemed pissed. Regardless of what I did, mainly I was leading them to set a higher standard for themselves. The desk subsequently went on a trading tear. A good teacher is most concerned with the improvement of their students and not being the most popular guy on the desk. As part of getting tough, sometimes a trader needs to be called out. When some of our developing traders first started getting good, they still lacked trades to hold for their playbook, and we ripped into them when they missed easy opportunities for trades to hold. G-Man would challenge, "Why aren't you still holding that tickster?" Steve would call out, "Dr. Momentum, that is a play you must be in." At first, our traders who were starting to do well did not like being called out. Some asked to speak with me in private. "Why is G-Man always on my case?" And, "Steve is so hard on me." I sat there, listened, and then had a flashback. I thought back to how guys were disciplined back in the day. A trader was sat in the middle of the trading floor, forced to wear a dunce cap for the entire day. This is certainly not a technique I would ever use. Then I spoke. "If we make you so uncomfortable for missing a trade, you will eventually become so disgusted with being called out that you will stop missing the trade." And I had a few sit-downs with some core traders unhappy with being called out. I explained that it was our job to make sure we did everything we could to motivate them to develop their trades to hold. We would continue to point out trades to hold after the close, so they knew which of these trades were most opportunistic. We lauded those who made successful trades to hold and spoke with traders who missed opportunities. And our guys improved. Today, some of those traders who spoke with me behind closed doors now are armed with trades to hold, and this is all that is important. Sacrifices. Great teachers must be unselfish. They must sacrifice a considerable amount of their trading profits as they improve their teaching. There are talks you must have when you are tired and want to head home. There are days you have to work when you want to rest. I talk through my trades with our newest traders in real time, which diminishes my focus and manifests missed trades. We have a training call to which our new traders are connected. I explain why I am buying, why I am selling, and what I am thinking. Together, our new traders and I trade a stock. But during this instruction, I miss trades explaining what I am thinking. Sometimes I am considering how to make a point more clearly, and I just miss a trading opportunity as my mind is focused on my explanation. I quickly finish my point and add, "I should have bought there instead of talking." and I choose stocks that are easiest for new traders to follow. This affects my overall profits. Here is a scene repeated frequently on our prop desk. Steve returns from his office after a discussion with a developing trader. Steve sits. Steve scans the markets. And then it comes. Steve, almost without fail, cries, "Oh, I cannot believe I missed that." One of the things I loved about being just a trader were the weekends off. Oh, do I miss the trips I took, the people I met, the fun I had. Those days are gone. Saturday is a work day. Sunday is a work day. There are conversations to rehearse to help our traders. There are new lectures to write. There are new trading patterns to discover and explain for our traders to exploit. There are better ways to teach that must be discovered. Even near the end of Mass on Sunday, my mind starts to make a list of things to accomplish. I shake hands with Father O'Connor, thank him for his sermon, leave Mass, and head back to work. Set firm values. A good teacher sets values. How should prop traders spend their day? What will their work ethic be? How will they judge their trading days? All this starts at the top. It begins with the teacher. Our traders are taught the value of hard work on my desk. I preach that fully developed trading skills is the answer to their trading consistency. I am an exceptionally hard worker. I stay late, work weekends, and work consistently. This is not lost on any trader on my desk. Our training program starts with a 5-week program where every minute for 10 hours a day is mapped out for them. And this is just the very first part of our training program. Next comes trader development. This allows me the legitimacy to preach hard work, and this rubs off on my desk. SMB recently spent a few days trading at another firm because of a tech emergency. The head trader of that firm asked, "How do you get your traders to sit in their seats so long? We can't get our guys to stay still for more than an hour." And these words came from an excellent prop trainer at an outstanding prop firm. I was very proud of our guys. In a new environment, with plenty of change to complain about, they sat, focused, and traded. The answer is because my partner Steve Spencer sits in his seat all day long and never misses a tick. Next, I'll share one of my favorite blogs that I wrote. Nothing can explain my teaching philosophy more than the following section. Not my trading setups, or when I sweep or offer, not when I load up. These are my values. 10x equals x. Maybe I am starting to get a little old. Maybe the half a generation removed from most of our traders is the difference. But I see a disturbing trend with a few developing traders and some potential new traders whom we interview. I want to emphasize that I see this with only a few. These new traders believe that if their work output is X, then their reward must be X. If only that were the case. When you begin as a trader, your work output must be 10x to make X. Let's discuss. I do not want you to be in that group of a few, and I have seen this with a few former talented individuals on our desk who consequently were asked to leave. And I see this with a few of our present traders who have all been talked to, and some of these above were the most talented people we have ever trained. But that is never enough for the market. Potential absent sustained effort is not rewarded by the market. What I see from my seat as a mentor on a trading desk is crystal clear. The developing traders who love trading and work at it do the best. Our most improved trader this month has done everything a developing trader is supposed to do and more, much, much more. Today, as he reviews his numbers for the month, there will be a huge smile on his face. Little things can make all the difference. Do you watch the markets trade during the midday and search for important levels into the close? Or do you take a 2-hour lunch? After the close, do you obsessively replay your trading day in your head and feed your mind with your best setups? Or are you immersed in fantasy baseball? Do you take all the time that is necessary to ensure that you are in the best trading stocks for your style before the open? Or do you settle on the first stock that could work? Do you work on your mental weaknesses by performing visualization exercises? Or do you just assume you don't need to do stuff like that? From my seat, most developing traders struggle when they first start. This is all part of the process, and then they have a choice. They can increase their work output to 10x, or, like all traders who fail, they can do 1/2x. After they start doing 1/2x, then their results are inevitably 3x. Traders who decide to do 10x then see X. Good thing I'm the product of an excellent public school district to get that math correct. With trading experience and a constant work product of 10x, developing traders see 2x and then 3x. Then, with this experience, their work product can decrease to 9x and see a gain up to 5x, and then 8x for a gain of 6x, and then 7x for a gain of 7x. Only after years of a work product that is not proportionally rewarded can they then see a work product that is properly rewarded. Last night I was at a Hall of Fame, HOF, dinner for a friend in upstate New York. One of the HOF recipients had passed. His wife spoke in his honor. Her speech was moving. This woman's accomplished husband had passed, and she was still so young. What was there really to gain from this speech? The people in the room respected her husband, which was why he was being inducted. Most of the people were her friends, so she didn't need to impress them. She was retired, so it's not like this was going to help her career. There was little for her to gain. And yet, this woman inspired the room. With the care she had taken with the preparation of her words, she shouted to everyone in the room, "If you are asked to do something, then you do it well. Do it with love." She never uttered these words, but it was in every line as she reflected on her husband's life. She had scoured his old yearbook, called up old friends for anecdotes, and asked her children what was most important about their father. She had worked on this 5-minute speech for days, with almost no reward to herself. In a room filled with mostly retired jocks, she left many in joyful tears, remembering the life of her HOF husband. We can all learn from this remarkable speech. If you want to be an HOF trader, then embrace the value of doing something well for the sake of doing something well. If you are asked to do something, then do it as well as you can. There really is nothing else that is as satisfying. For the developing trader, 10x equals X. The new trader who values hard work just may very well become a superstar trader. Believe in the student. A good teacher believes in every one of their students. Let me share an anecdote where my belief may have helped a future star trader. Tixter did not excel when he first started. I saw his talent, his unordinary ability to process information, his lavish passion for the markets. After about a year, he was doing okay, but still not as well as I perceived he could. I had a talk with him. We talked about trading adjustments, and then I finished with, "You will be the next great trader on our desk." He improved dramatically, but still not as good as I knew he could be. I had another talk with him. Again, I looked him squarely in the eyes, paused, and finished with, "You are going to be the next great trader on our desk." He improved some more. There is another trader on our desk, JLA, almost ready for this talk, but I am not quite ready for it yet. You cannot give these talks until you really believe them. I believed that Tixter was ready. He needed to believe. It was my job to plant this thought in his head and repeat it. There are traders who just need to be told they are ready. They are like great thoroughbreds that just need a whip from their jockey. It's time. They can do it. They just need to be led with a teacher's personal belief in them. There's always more to learn. It is an excellent idea for all of us to reach out to great traders. I do, and I learn from them. Some are also effective teachers. I am interested in what they are trading and why. I love to hear the stories of their great trades. But I know that I trade differently. When I play pickup basketball, I do not attempt a 360 reverse jam on a breakaway. I can barely touch the rim these days as it is. Walter Peters, in his article, What I Learned from the Best Trader I Have Ever Known, shares what he learned from his millionaire trader friend. Particularly interesting is Mr. Peters learned from his millionaire trader friend that you do not have to reinvent the wheel. Mr. Peters learned that you must find a system from existing systems that make sense to you, that you can let trades come to you, and you should continually learn. John Netto of Net Black Capital made the point in an interview that what we can learn from a great trader is one's trading is just a mirror of one's life. To be a disciplined trader, you must first, in fact, be disciplined in your life. We saw the importance of this with Mad Max earlier. What good does it do to teach a new trader to trade with discipline if he is not disciplined in his own life? Here is what I learned from a good friend of SMB and respected trading educator, Brian Shannon. 10 Things I Learned from a Professional Trader, Brian Shannon. Brian Shannon of www.alphatrends.net and Tweet Alpha Trends was our special guest speaker yesterday. During a busy week of trading, the NYC Trader Expo, and meetings, SMB was grateful that our good friend found some time to talk with our desk. It was a lecture not to be missed. Thank you, Brian. Here are 10 things that I learned from Brian's lecture. 1. Brian does more preparation than 98% of all the traders with whom I have traded or trained. 2. Brian knows exactly how he makes money as a trader and which setups are best for him. 3. Brian accepts that the trading patterns that are best for him often may not work. 4. Brian reduces his risk in trades that are not working for him quickly. 5. Brian trades stocks in play just like SMB, but he goes about his search distinctly. He carries around a list of 200 stocks he most wants to watch during a given period, and then hammers down from these options daily. 6. Brian readily admits 2 weaknesses in his trading, which are also mine: selling too early and not having size for the entire move. There is no destination for a trader. There is nothing to get. There is only continually working to improve every day. 7. Brian knows more about technical analysis than almost all traders, but seeks confirmation from the order flow. 8. Brian shares that a setup may not work the first or second time, but he has the confidence and persistence to stay with his best setups and make that third trade, which may lead to a winner. 9. Brian left me an autographed copy of his book, Technical Analysis Using Multiple Time Frames, as a gift, and could use some help with his handwriting. But seriously, what an awesome gift. 10. Brian loves drinking with G-Man. Hard to meet a better person and trader to learn from than Brian Shannon of alphatrends.net. I have been trading for 12 years. I have traded multiple financial and geopolitical crises, as well as dull markets. I had a run before very recently where I had been positive every single month for 5 years, save one. I've read hundreds of books on coaching and trading. I have a law degree, and I run a trading firm that is recognized for its exceptional training program. But when I need advice, I contact the best trading teacher that I know. We are all perpetual developing traders, and I recognize there is always more to learn. If you are a new trader or an experienced trader who needs some advice, then find the best teacher. Let's end our discussion with an idea that separates the experienced trader from the novice, the winning trader from the underperformer, the consistently profitable trader from the up and down. It's a skill all great traders possess. It is the ability to adapt. Chapter 12. Adapt to the Markets. There is nothing to get as a trader. What works one month may not the next. Trading setups you crush one year may be extinct the next. As prop traders, our job is to recognize present patterns and exploit them. But we also must have the humility to accept that these patterns might change at any moment. And when they do, we must find new patterns. We must adapt. But before I delve into the details of how I have had to adapt my trading style throughout the years, I can't help but tell the story of my first interview. During the spring of 1997, I attended an interview in New York City with an upstart prop trading firm. As if I were still in high school and applying for a lifeguarding job at the local country club, my mother drove me. It wasn't around the corner either. My mom drove me all the way from our house in Port Jefferson, over an hour away from Manhattan. I changed into my Wall Street Power Dealmaker uniform in the parking lot of the Omni Hotel. I wore a blue pinstripe Hugo Boss suit, a red Armani power tie, and Ferragamo shoes. I was a mix of a high-profile basketball coach and Gordon Gekko, minus the suspenders. I looked good. Damn good. But my GQ wardrobe was unnecessary, if not irrelevant. I was a friend of a friend, and as long as I did not show up drunk, I was getting this job. My first question from the head of the firm's HR department was naturally, "Why do you want to be a trader?" True to the lines I had been rehearsing in the car ride over, I confidently replied, "Trading is a meritocracy. I want to earn a salary commensurate with my production. I enjoy the fast pace of the trading environment, and I thrive on daily challenges." Using that word meritocracy was code for, "I have a friend who prepped me on exactly what you want to hear, so you can save some time and move on to your next candidate, because I have all the correct answers ready to go." Again, I was getting a job offer. The business hadn't quite evolved to the recruiting matrixes that Steve and I would design years later. Even though I had the job in hand, I took the Connecticut bar exam anyway in the summer of 1997. I'm not sure why. Perhaps I wanted something to fall back on in case I did not succeed as a trader. I passed. Phew. Then I signed up for the Series 7, which, by the way, for those who have heard otherwise, is not a difficult exam. This was my summer and fall of noteworthy exams. So I had options. What I did not know, nor could have ever imagined, was what was about to happen next. I am not one of those people who dreamed of being a trader since childhood. Actually, I wanted to pitch for the Yankees, but at UConn I learned, like many college athletes, that that was not going to happen. What I knew about my new job was that I was likely to make $180,000 in my first year. I could wear pretty much whatever I wanted. I could make even more when I traded my own account. I might get to travel via helicopter to Newport, Rhode Island on the weekends, like some of the firm's traders. And I got to do something fun. Why exactly did I go to law school again? During the economic recession of 2008-2009, the media sometimes acts as if the indulgent life is over. They all have short memories. My generation of traders I started with got a taste of cold reality during the Asian financial crisis. That was the first time we all realized that trading was not quite the money-for-nothing and chicks-for-free life it was purported to be. Many on the desk were struggling. For the first time in the firm's history, people were fired, with whispers that more were coming. Many were in a hole for the year. I was not making money during the first half of my rookie year. Many on our desk were nervous that we could make money going forward. But at the end of the year, the market improved, and through grit and patience, we made it through. This was just a bad time that we needed to survive. Once the fears subsided, my first great month happened. I got a check for $30,000. I did not know anyone else who made $30,000 in a month. I'm sure if I ask my parents now, they'll probably tell me when they were first married that they didn't make that amount in a year, combined. I was essentially playing an awesome video game all day, while my law school peers were writing some obscure briefs on, insert the most boring legal topic you could possibly think of here. And I had just made $30,000. The Asian Financial Crisis. The popular strategy that enabled me to show off my nouveau riches was a subset of swing trading. We traded relative strength plays. We bought stocks that indicated they were stronger than the market on a given day. We traded high beta NASDAQ stocks exclusively. Our bread and butter stocks were Cisco, Dell, Microsoft, Intel, the semiconductors of Applied Materials, KLA-Tencor, and Novellus. At the time, we did not have access to NYSE stocks, but we didn't care. I'll take $30,000 a month over NYSE access, or so I thought. Our day included watching the NASDAQ futures and extrapolating how strong or weak the stocks were. So if we were watching tech stocks, the NASDAQ futures went up 5 points, and Cisco went up 0.5 point. Microsoft did not move, and Intel went up 1 point. Then we would focus on loading up in Intel. Keep in mind this was before stock prices became decimalized. The movements came in quarters, 25 cents, and halves, 50 cents, of a dollar. As a result, swings were rapid, and we moved our money around to those that were stronger than the market. At 3 p.m., we found the strongest stocks and loaded up. 3 o'clock lightning, we called it. And we would hold our best positions till the closing bell. Our superior trading platform also provided us a huge advantage over others on the street. Our platform would show prints executed on ISLD, which is now NASD. Sometimes market makers would pay through 25 to 50 cents for a stock, and we knew first. Let me explain. We would be trading Microsoft and would see a print through on ISLD for 25 to 50 cents, bought by Goldman. Yet we could still buy the stock on the offer at the inside market. We would pick off the offer at 25 cents and put our stock up for 50 cents and instantly get filled. Our platform could offer us information that a Goldman or Morgan was willing to pay through the offer. So we would buy and assume there was more to be bought by an institutional player. We could easily make 50 cents on a few thousand shares in less than 5 seconds. Now that really was money for nothing. We made a lot of money in bounce plays as well. When Intel, Cisco, Microsoft would open down considerably, we would get long to catch a bounce on the open. When they held higher, we would get longer. I still use this old-school bounce play. Rule number one, do not be the first to buy. Let the market stop going down, and then dip your toes into the water and buy a little. Let the stocks hold higher, and then when they do, this is when you load up. You only take on huge positions after the market has stopped going down and the stocks and market has held higher. Don't be a hero and try to be the first one to catch the bottom. There is more money in loading up after the stocks hold higher. I have seen prop traders make over $400,000 in a bounce. They did not load up at the bottom. I've seen Steve make over $100,000 twice in bounces. He did not buy the bottom. The Internet Boom. As if picking off market makers and riding bounces off the open weren't enough, then came the dot-coms. AOL, Yahoo, eBay, Amazon, KTEL, Lycos, Excite, Broadcom, VeriSign, JDSU, Just Don't Sell Us, Oops, Juniper, QCOM. We went from swing traders to momentum traders. Just as we gutted out the Asia crisis, we had to adapt. I always find it funny when people think that trading back in those days was easy. If anything, it was a lot more nerve-wracking. Try buying 5,000 shares of stock that could drop 10 points in 5 seconds. And our mindset as traders before this whole internet thing was to be deliberate swing traders. We bought into pullbacks. We bought at great prices. And now we had to pay the offer a point above the last print in a stock that had no revenues and that had gone up 100% in 2 days. If the stock didn't move, we would lose a point just because that was the spread. If we were wrong, we would lose 3 points. And we traded multiple 1,000-share lots. I never started a position with less than 3,000 shares back in the day. So basically, if we paid the offer in a stock and it did not lift and trade higher, we could lose $9,000 in less than a few seconds. This was not money for nothing and chicks for free. This was the market mistress taking our money and the chicks fleeing in droves. Most of the better traders then were trading their own money, not from a proprietary partnership pool. So while a good day for me could be $10,000 to $25,000 on an average day, I could also lose $10,000 by losing my focus for just a few moments. But really, the biggest adjustment was our mindset. We were defensive traders, now turned offensive. We were like defensive fighters now being mandated to let our hands go. If we didn't, then we would not make money. Our floor was packed. The ceilings were 8 feet high, like a traditional New York apartment. Traders had room for a chair and a few inches on each side, and that was it. We had no supporting analysts to help us crunch the proper valuation of any of these stocks we were buying. There were no charts. We had one computer screen, a dinosaur CRT monitor. Our trading platform, as innovative as it was, could go down at any minute, and for hours. And when it did, you were just stuck with your positions. There was no help desk to call to sell you out. There was just hope, the hope that you wouldn't get killed until the platform worked again. And this was the best equities platform on the street at this time. I remember losing $18,000 the day KTEL, now delisted, announced they might start selling music over the internet. My mentor pulled me aside and noted that I had shown an ability to put up explosive numbers but needed to control my implosions. From this day on, I worked on consistency. I passed on upside in favor of trades that were best for me. I was like many new traders, thinking trading is about making money instead of one good trade at a time. My check at the end of the month was profits minus losses, not just the gains. I started to concentrate on putting together smaller positive days. To this day, I embrace this philosophy. On the positive side, there was a day when I was up $75,000 in eBay and Yahoo. There was a long streak, about 18 months, of mostly five-figure days. I laugh thinking back at it now, and I remember receiving a credit card bill for $15,000 and writing a check like I was paying for coffee from a street cart vendor. Reality set in a few months later, though. I had landed in Savannah, Georgia for a week of golf in Hilton Head and answered a call from my accountant. He told me how much I would owe in taxes. I would repeat the number, but it was so obscene, I can't even write it. Clearly, I also needed a new accountant. During the internet boom, we were relative strength traders turned momentum traders. We traded exclusively from the long side, and only traded NASDAQ securities. But as much opportunity as this internet boom offered, it was our ability to adapt to this new market that booked our outlandish profits. In early 2000, George Soros famously warned, "The market today is dominated by much younger people who have not experienced a bear market." Hard times were about to visit. The bounces of 2001. While the internet bubble was bursting, our daily profits plummeted. We did not short. We were not even allowed to short. We did not know how to short. If anything, our psychology was to wait for a pullback and load up. And this is what we did from the long side as the bubble started to burst. Even though stocks were trading lower, we were still able to make some money. We had superior trading skills. We kept our stops tight. We focused on the quality internet stocks. If Amazon went down 3 points, up a point, then down three, then we were in that 1 point up move. Our win rate decreased, but we adjusted quickly. We waited for better long opportunities. We learned technical analysis for this new market very quickly, finding the safest places to start our long positions. But we were not making as much money as we had. Five-figure days had gone the way of vinyl records, as now you really could download music over the internet. During 2001, I made a living playing two historic bounces on the NASDAQ and grinding it out. On January 3, 2001, the Fed unexpectedly cut rates 50 basis points. When this news broke, I immediately bought 8,000 shares of Broadcom. That was a memorable trade and a fortunate one. Broadcom first ticked down after I bought. A possible 20,000-plus rip was staring at me. That will give you an instant shot of adrenaline. Here's the exchange between Steve and me at that moment. Bella. Oh, that is not good. Spencer. No, just give it a few seconds. Bella. Okay. A few seconds pass. Bella. I just got taken on the offer in Broadcom 8 points higher. Soon enough, Broadcom popped up immediately, and I was selling on the offer and reloading 5 points lower. See figure 12.1 on your bonus material. I made more than $100,000 in less than an hour. Many guys in our firm made much more in this bounce. And this was just the first few ticks in that historic bounce. NASDAQ bounced 14% intraday. That is 2 years of movement in a few hours. On April 18, 2001, the Fed again surprisingly cut rates 50 basis points intraday. The NASDAQ exploded 8.1% to the upside. This was another huge day. In 2001, there were 11 rate cuts by the Fed as the market collapsed toward new lows not seen in years. Despite the end of the consecutive streaks of five-figure days, this was our year. How to play a market bounce. As an intraday trader, I have learned information gained from watching my stocks print, and trade was superior to the charts. I ripped through some charts after one close in January of 2009 to prepare for the next trading session. It was hard not to notice that everything traded down this day, and most of everything finished near its lows. GS, WFC, RIM, Apple, IBM, all the bigger stocks were sold. And now, from a technical standpoint, I knew that SPY 8850 was important. Technically, we should bounce off of SPY 8850, I thought. SPY traded between 8850 and 8893 for a while before finally breaking out. We should have specially bounced off of this level the first time. But I recognized that I must do more than just get ready to play a bounce off of 8850. 1. Will the bounce start above 8850? If so, what will I look for to enter this trade? 2. Is there some selling in the market that should cause me pause to play the 8850 SPY bounce? I need to talk with the guys on our desk that have seen the selling to make a better determination. 3. What stocks will I play for a bounce? IMB, GS, RIM, Apple, FCX, WFC seem the most obvious, but I must look through my charts to find the best stocks for me. 4. We are still a distance from 8850. How can I make money on the short side down to 8850? 5. What happens if we break 8850 SPY? What is my trade then? Remember, if you are playing for a bounce of 8850 SPY, have a list of stocks ready to go with great prices. Near 8850, buy just a taste of the stocks you wish to trade. Wait for SPY to hold higher. See which of the stocks that you bought a taste of are trading the strongest. Buy more of these stocks. Below 8850 SPY, you must exit your stocks. Set plans to exit your stocks if they trade in your favor. Fundamentally, this is how you trade the 8850 SPY level. That is how you play a market bounce. But what about a bounce in just one stock? A single stock bounce. ROH tanked on the open. Fading it on the long side was like trying to catch a falling knife. And many of you have heard the street expression, don't catch a falling knife. These tank jobs in ROH happen every day. As we discussed during our SMB morning meeting, it is a mistake for a new trader to try to catch the bottom. Let's discuss. It is human nature for some traders to try to catch the bottom of the market or a stock. Some wish to be that one trader who was correct while others on the street were wrong. Some desire to be that guy on the desk who calls the bottom and receives the adulation from other traders. But this is just ego. And trading to stroke your ego will manifest a short trading career. The object is to make money consistently. Not try to prove you are smarter than others. You will make the most money in a bounce after the market or a stock has stabilized and held higher. trying to get long at 47.50 yesterday, though the bottom in ROH yesterday is bad trading for new and most experienced traders. Traders will often comment that a stock feels like the bottom, and that may be the case, but with a stock falling quickly,